Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, healthcare in America has not improved in the ways envisioned, and in fact, for many people, it's gotten worse. But there's a better way, one that frees patients, doctors, institutions, and employers from the sneers of regulation and perverse incentives that hold everybody back. We'll find out how today. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Conversations, where today we will consider the path-breaking new book called Priceless, Curing the Healthcare Crisis. And to do so, we welcome its author, Independent Institute Senior Fellow John C. Goodman. Welcome, John.
Glad to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Here's the book. I'm really excited about it, published by the Independent Institute, Priceless. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But first, let me tell our friends, remind our friends who don't already know, that you, John C. Goodman, are a senior fellow of the Independent Institute, president of the Goodman Institute for Public Policy Research. You appear frequently in the Wall Street Journal, which has called you the father of health savings accounts. You've testified before Congress. You wrote the trailblazing book, Patient Power, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis. You've been on Fox News, CNN, CNBC, USA Today, Forbes have featured your writings. You're kind of out there, John, and the main thing people should realize about you is that you have thought long and deeply about healthcare policy. So thanks for all that work.
Well, thanks for that introduction. Makes me think I should run for office.
Hey, you should.
I approve that message.
There you go. There you go. So, okay, here we are. It is 2024. And we are still puzzling over healthcare policy in the United States. Back in 2010, President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act, which then, of course, really first became well known to the public for its very glitchy online rollout with a glitchy website and so forth. A lot of people remember that. But most people know Obamacare or the ACA because of the way it has structured and really narrowed people's options. According to you, we're in some traps because of ACA, Obamacare. Can you tell us how we're trapped by the Affordable Care Act, John?
Well, it's basically destroyed the individual market. And by individual, I mean the market in which you buy your own insurance if you don't get it from an employer or from government. What a lot of people don't realize is that with the second set of subsidies that Congress enacted over the last couple of years, health insurance is basically free. If you have average income, your premium is probably zero. 80% of the people pay $10 a month or less. And if you're healthy, your preventive care is the only care you need. That's also free. So if you're healthy, your options have never been better. But if you're sick, your options have never been worse. The policy sold in Obamacare, they look like Medicaid with a high deductible. Your out-of-pocket exposure is $9,400 per person. Twice that, almost $19,000 for a family, and you have to pay that every year. So totally different from what we were promised. When Obamacare was passed, no one said, this is going to be great for healthy, bad for sick. It was the other way around. They said, this is to protect people with chronic illness.
Yeah, and nobody with pre-existing conditions will have to worry ever again. And all the uninsured people were going to be insured. And you can choose your own doctor. I remember that was like the really great big promise.
Well, what that promise implied was that the kind of insurance you're going to get would look like an ordinary Blue Cross plan. In other words, no reason to fear. It's just going to be something you're familiar with. Well, that's not what happened. In fact, Blue Cross of Texas also thought it was going to, that's the way the market was going to evolve. And so they put out the same plan that they sell to small businesses and large businesses. You could see any doctor, go in any hospital. And they lost almost $1 billion in 2 years. And so they left the market. And the firm that was the most successful is called Centene. And it began life as a Medicaid contractor, and it has a fifth of all the plans in the country right now. And the Centene plan pays basically Medicaid rates. And so if you're a doctor, you don't want to accept Medicaid managed care, then you're not in their network. Same for the hospitals. So here in Dallas, UT Southwestern Medical Center, probably one of the best medical centers in the whole world,
right?
You can't buy individual insurance that gets you in. And the same thing for Baylor Medical Center here in Dallas, MD Anderson down in Houston, across the country, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, they're just not accepting the plans that are offered because the payment rates are so low. And managed care means that after the hospital performs surgery or some other procedure, the insurer can come back and question whether it should have been done in the first place. So what we have is a market where you don't have access to the best doctors and the best hospitals. And if you have expensive procedures, you're going to pay a lot out of pocket.
Wow. So this means that, in fact, unless these companies were forced to opt into the system, they remain free not to participate, which means that the best providers are not in the system for those who are under Obamacare. Have I got that right?
Yes. It's just like Medicaid managed care. In this country, about two-thirds of everyone who's in Medicaid is being managed by a private entity. And they can be very aggressive in arguing with doctors and hospitals about procedures and demanding pre-authorization. And so some of our veteran institutions don't want to fool with that. It's not worth it. And why that's bad for you, the patient, is that not only are these doctors and institutions not in your plan, but if you go outside your plan, the plan pays nothing.
Right. Wow. So the reason they're outside the plan, this is sort of the heart of the matter. Is it because there are money-grubbing, stingy, bad companies?
It's because the Obamacare plans pay is well below what private plans pay and even below what Medicare pays. And
Medicare is not generous to the providers, as I understand it.
Not generous, but Medicaid is even less. And,
yeah.
And when I say it's Medicaid rates, it's Medicaid or just a little above Medicaid. So institutions that don't take Medicaid typically will not take what's being sold all across the country in the individual market.
So we are kind of in a cul-de-sac here with this problem. It just has put millions of people in a situation where they can't access good quality care, and they can't access their own individual insurance coverage very easily. What can be done?
Well, there is an exception to all this, and it's called short-term insurance. It's been around for a long time. It's the kind of insurance that takes, say, a kid from home to college, covers that gap, or leaving college to go to work, or going from one job to another job. As the name implies, it covers short-term gaps in coverage. And it's basically unregulated. It's not regulated by Obamacare, not regulated by most state governments.
Because it's
about the closest thing there is out there to a free market for health insurance. So under President Obama, we got an executive order. Congress had no say in it, from the White House, saying that no one can have this kind of insurance if it lasts more than 3 months. So that's it. And so Trump comes into office and totally reverse that. So no, you can have it for a year and you can renew for two more years. So we can go 3 years. And after the 3 years, you can do it again.
So you can kind of have your own insurance in perpetuity if you keep re-upping.
Yes. And here Biden comes in and just this last spring goes back to the Obama approach. You can only have this for 3 months. You can't renew. And so we've been flip-flopping all this.
Right.
But this is an alternative. The premiums are, can be as low as half of what the same insurance would cost you in the regular Obamacare regulated individual market. It meets people's financial needs and their healthcare needs. And so just the bottom line is we ought to allow people to buy insurance that meets their healthcare needs and their financial needs.
Right. The key issue here seems to be that government restriction, blocked and then allowed and then blocked this less regulated option for insurance.
That's right. And it doesn't cover everything. It may not cover substance abuse, for example. And so one objection is, well, what if you buy this insurance? And because you don't think anybody in your family is abusing substances, But turns out you have a kid that's got a drug problem.
Right.
Then what happens? You don't have coverage. And
right.
my answer is then you go back to Obamacare. You
yeah.
go back to
yeah.
the, because we're not going to abolish Obamacare anytime in, probably not in your lifetime. How is that?
Could it be changed? Could it be changed sufficiently to make it unrecognizable is my question.
Absolutely. That's, absolutely.
Yeah, it could
and part
be.
Of the change is let it become a risk pool. Let it become a place to solve problems that the market doesn't solve. And that should always be the way we think about the role of government. We should let the private sector meet all the needs it can because it'll always do better than government. But if there are some important needs that aren't being met, like Jimmy Kimmel's baby, as some people may remember, $1 million baby, okay, if that's not covered by the private sector, then that's where the safety net kicks in.
Just to remind our listeners, we are talking with John C. Goodman, who is the author of this new book, Priceless, Curing the Healthcare Crisis, which has recently been published by Independent Institute. And this is actually a second edition of an earlier book that you wrote under the same general title, I think, what, right at the opening of the Obamacare era. And now you've updated it. The old book looked like this. It had a red apple on it, and the new version, fully updated, has the green apple, so we don't get confused. Why did you feel it necessary to create another edition of this book, John?
Well, you know, the word priceless there is a double entendre.
Right.
Your health care is priceless, but also the system that provides you with health care. Your health is priceless, but the health care system also is absent prices.
It has and no so, prices.
No. None of us in healthcare ever sees a real price for anything. No employer, no employee, no doctor, no patient. All the prices are artificial. And so no one knows what anything really costs. And that's the problem. When you have artificial prices, we all face perverse incentives. And I mean literally everybody. If somebody is paying all my medical bills, I have a perverse incentive to overconsume care, to get MRI scans and other tests that maybe I wouldn't purchase if I did a cost benefit analysis. And doctors who are paid fee for service have incentive to overprovide. And insurance companies have incentive to underprovide to save money. And so everybody in this system has incentive to do something that's bad for the system as a whole.
Now, when we say there are no real prices, I mean, some of us ordinary people are scratching our heads saying, well, I know that when I go to the doctor, you know, there's some kind of a copay that I pay. And then my little statement says that the insurance paid so much and I paid so much. I mean, there are prices, John. Why do you say there aren't real prices?
Well, when you go to the doctor's office, if you're a Blue Cross patient, the doctor gets paid one rate. If you're Aetna, there's another rate. If you're Cigna, there's a third rate. Medicare, another. Medicaid, another. None of these are, you don't see that when you go to the grocery store.
No.
If you're a Medicare patient, a tomato costs the same as if you're
right.
a Blue Cross patient. So that's what I mean by no real prices. They're artificial transfers of money that don't reflect what we ordinarily think of as a market price.
And the reason we have artificial pricing is because of the structure of regulation by the Affordable Care Act and other regulations. Have I got that right, John? That's the reason
why. Well, it's broader than that.
Okay.
What the Affordable Care Act is what some people call Obamacare, and that was just tacked onto the system. But before Obamacare, it was still true that all the prices were artificial, and that was because of previous regulation.
Right.
We've been
right.
regulating the healthcare marketplace for 125 years at least, the doctors were the bad actors 100 years ago, wanting to act like a cartel and keep other people from competing with them. But then we moved to hospitals and to health insurance. And so now virtually every aspect of healthcare is regulated, and the regulations too often give us perverse incentives.
So you've said that the U.S. has actually may not have the most expensive healthcare system in the world if you look at the real value of the care and the real cost. What did you mean when you said the U.S. may not have the most expensive healthcare system in the world?
Well, if you go back to the idea that these prices are not real prices, they're artificial numbers, their phony numbers, if you like. The way national income accounting works in every country is you add up all the transactions and get a total number. But if all the transactions are made at phony prices, then the big number is phony. So if you look at the total amount spent at gross national product accounting around the world in different countries, those numbers are unreliable numbers. It's not clear what they mean. Another way of looking at healthcare is to say, well, how many doctors are out there per capita? You know, how many hospital beds? How many hospital procedures? And when you count that way, we're not at the top. Now, we're about in the middle in doctors per capita, in the middle on hospital procedures. So in terms of real resources, we are using fewer real resources, but getting really better results.
And I suppose that's because the major comparisons are countries like the UK and Canada and elsewhere, which have a much more seriously government-controlled healthcare system than we do. It seems, for example, that in the National Health System, National Health Service in the UK, people feel happy about it because they know they can get care, except that when it comes right down to getting care, because the regulations in the UK are so stringent, they have to wait too long to get the care. It's a strange comparison. Healthcare is virtually free, except that you can't get it. Whereas here, it's expensive, but you can get at least a little bit more of it. Is that right?
Yes, although we're becoming more and more like Britain and Canada every
day.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
We're getting more like them because we bought into this notion that no one should ever have to choose between healthcare and other uses of money. And so you said when you go to the doctor in Britain or Canada, it's free. When you go to the doctor in this country, it's almost free. Every time we spend a dollar at the doctor's office, only 10 cents is coming out of our pocket, and the other 90 cents is paid for by an employer, insurance company, or government. So we're not really paying for care with money. We're paying with time. And the waiting times in the United States keep growing. It takes 3.5 weeks on average to see a new doctor in this country. So yes, Canada has long waiting lines for care. So does Britain, but they're getting longer in this country as well.
Yeah, and we're moving in their direction. And the reason we're moving in their direction, apparently, from what I can understand about your analysis, is that the level of regulation has become incrementally or increasingly greater, so that we are approaching toward the level of regulation experienced by the medical community in Canada and in the UK. But we haven't gotten there yet.
Right. I would say regulation plus tax and spending policies that encourage all the money to go through third-party payers. Third-party payers are employer, government, and insurance companies. So we're very rarely buying care with money that we control and own. And if someone else is paying for it, then you automatically have a bureaucracy, because Blue Cross doesn't want you to spend like a drunken sailor. So when you're about to enter the hospital or have an MRI scan, they say, well, wait a minute, we want to know why this is going on. And so they ask the doctor, and it goes back and forth. And we spend a great deal of time and money in that kind of bureaucratic environment.
As we speak, John, we are in the midst, of course, of a presidential campaign. The issues will be perennial, but they're certainly focused in these days. In a recent debate between the two presidential candidates here in the U.S., what I heard when I was listening to that was one candidate who may or may not support full government control of healthcare, who may or may not be in favor of full payer. That's not clear to me. And then the other candidate who says, well, yeah, he has kind of like, he doesn't have a health policy plan. He has a concept for an eventual sort of hypothetical plan. I think that these candidates need to hear from someone like you. What is the way to solve the problem? Because they both seem confused.
Well, and it's a shame, because a lot of deregulation occurred under Donald Trump, but he doesn't seem to be aware of. And I've told his folks, you know, he ought to hold up the cell phone to his ear when he's talking and say, I got this for you. When I was elected president, it was not legal for a doctor to bill Medicare for talking on the phone to a patient. And COVID comes along, Congress gives him emergency authority, and the Trump folks over at CMS, they were ready. They had already planned for this. And because of the Trump executive order, which again is temporary, it's not permanent, that's why you can talk to your doctor by phone, Zoom, and Skype. And so that was really important, allowing employers to give insurance to their employees that they own and can take with them when they leave. That was a Trump deregulation executive order, allowing people with health savings accounts to get free insulin, say, from an employer without jeopardizing their health savings account. That was a result of an executive order. The vaccine itself, University of Chicago economists think that because of the speed up, we deregulated vaccine production before COVID, and that was a Trump move. So they estimated at the University of Chicago that 160,000 lives were saved because of that one deregulation order.
So those didn't add up to a comprehensive redo of the whole system, but they were incremental steps away from comprehensive control. Am I got that right?
Yes, and also the Trump Health and Human Services, what's called CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, they put out a document that looks pretty much like my book, Priceless. It's not as well written, I might add. But,
well, I'm sure not.
A lot of the ideas that you'll find in that book, Priceless, were adopted by the Trump administration in their white paper.
Yeah, but not fully implemented.
No, not fully implemented.
Not statutorily enacted by Congress.
But whatever they could do by executive order, they did. They were very aggressive. And I'm not sure Trump even realizes it because, you know, all he has to do is sign the executive order. He doesn't have to read it.
Right. Well, I was looking in chapter 14 of this book, which is Priceless, second edition. And in chapter 14, you have this section called Getting From Here to There, which I kind of perked my eyes up when I got there. And you have the section called Steps Already Taken, and then Steps Needed, and so forth. But it would have been pretty simple for candidate now Trump to enumerate the steps he had already taken. But I didn't hear anything about that.
No, he hasn't. And I've met with Trump's think tank people who are, you know, preparing for the next administration if he wins. And
right.
I have told them, you know, your candidate needs to go out there and brag about what he's done already. And as I said earlier, most of what he did is not permanent law. The executive
right.
order can be undone by the next president.
And President Biden undid a good bit of it, you said.
For the short-term insurance, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the question of portability? I mean, so what's interesting to me, sort of as a political observer, is that people like Senator Sanders of Vermont, who supports what we call single payer, which is just to say a government-run, top-to-bottom healthcare insurance and provision system, they want that to take over from employer-based health insurance accounts. And so that makes me nervous. I want to keep my employer-based insurance and not have the government take over everything. But on the other hand, seems like a number of people in the business community wouldn't really mind too much if the government took it all over because it'd get it off their backs. But you say there's another alternative either to the current system where there's this very mixed system of employer-based and non-employer-based on the one hand, or total government control on the other hand. You talk about portability of insurance that is not employer-based and is not government-controlled. What does that mean, John?
Well, think about your 401k. It travels with you. So you go to work and your employer can make deposits to your 401k account. You leave that employer, go to another one, the account remains yours. And there's no reason why health insurance couldn't work the same way, that you have a health plan. And when you accept a new job, you negotiate your salary, but you also negotiate what kind of fringe benefits you're going to get. And part of that is what contribution will your employer make to your health account. This isn't rocket science. This is something we already know how to do, and we ought to be thinking that way.
So you're saying that it would be possible in principle to eliminate all the employer-based health plans or at least make it optional, and allow people to have their own purchased health insurance plan, which they could purchase with dollars provided to them by their employer, but not the system, not the coverage provided through their employer.
That's right. Now, the reason why employers are involved is because for most of the time since World War II, there was very little subsidy for you if you bought your own insurance. But if your employer bought it for you, it was completely excluded from your taxable income. So let's say a family plan costs $20,000 a year. If your employer gave that to you in wages, and you're in the 50% tax bracket, the government takes half of it. But if your employer gives it to you as a Blue Cross plan, you don't pay any tax. So that's why employers got involved.
So it was a tax incentive deal.
Yes.
I see. Throughout the book, this issue of incentives comes up over and over again. You say that there are perverse incentives throughout the system, and you also argue that there could be salutary, helpful incentives if they were restructured. Unpack that a little bit, if you could.
Well, let's take the example I just gave you, the $20,000 family plan. Well, what if we spend one more dollar just because we want more stuff in our plan? Well, if we gave that to the employee in the form of wages, and I'm in the 50% bracket, the government gets 50 cents. But if we spend that one more dollar on healthcare coverage, the government doesn't get anything. So
right.
We're encouraged in that case to keep spending on health insurance until it's worth 50 cents on the dollar to us. And so that's our perverse incentive as an employee, that that health insurance, we're overinsured, if you like. And we're overinsured because we make it very expensive to take a benefit as take-home pay, and we encourage you to take a fringe benefit instead.
Could these perverse incentives be eliminated or restructured, and what would it take?
Well, actually, it's a very simple idea that we start giving tax breaks to employer-provided insurance the same way we're actually doing in Obamacare. And that is with a fixed sum tax credit, which means you get so many dollars of tax relief, and that's it. So instead of each dollar you spend avoiding a marginal tax rate, they say to the family, okay, you get, let's say, $8,000 of tax credit money for health insurance, and everything you spend above the eight comes out of, is a substitute for take-home pay. So we fix the subsidy so that it does not give you the perverse incentive to overinsure.
And changing that subsidy would require an act of Congress. Is that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And it would have to be part probably of a larger set of restructurings that could be enacted by Congress, or some of which could be enacted temporarily by executive order?
No. Now, back when in 2008, John McCain actually ran on this plan. He ran on this idea. I helped him with the platform. And he ran against Barack Obama. And here's something interesting. When Obama got to the White House, this is not known by most people, his own advisors said, look, why don't you adopt the McCain health plan? Because we don't have any better ideas, and it's got a lot of good features.
Brilliant.
And Republicans would have a hard time opposing it since it was McCain's plan. And it was Axelrod who said, no, we can't do that. We just spent $100 million demagoguing McCain plan. How can we turn around and say, now we think it's a good idea? And it's been introduced in Congress by a number of times. So there is some support for it, but not enough to make it law anytime in the near future.
Right, right. And we don't really know where candidate Harris stands vis-a-vis this kind of change, do we? Because it's hard to tell where she stands on it.
Well, Kamala Harris has a bias against the private sector, and most people in the Democratic Party do. They think that it's going to work better if government spends the money rather than private spending, and yet common sense tells you it's the other way around, that when people are spending their money privately, they're more careful about how they spend it.
Right, right. And those with lower incomes could simply be given, tax credits or in this ideal system that we could come back to, they could be kind of at the same level playing field, but without the government controlling all the healthcare. Is that right?
Yes, and we could do a lot. Those with low incomes tend to be on Medicaid. And it's, as we said earlier, Medicaid pays low rates because so many doctors won't see Medicaid patients. They end up in the emergency room. In fact, when people enroll in Medicaid, their trips to the emergency room increase by 40%. But we could begin liberation right there. In fact, the greatest need is with people with low incomes because it's hard for them to get access to the care they need. And we could say, well, let them buy care the way they buy food. When you have food stamps, you go in the supermarket and you put the food stamp down, you add your cash to it. If you did that with healthcare, if you went to the MinuteClinic and you said, well, here's Medicaid, but I'll top it up to pay the market price with cash. If the nurse takes the cash, she could go to prison. So not only
really?
Do we not allow it, we've criminalized.
You're kidding. So if you offer to pay more than the amount to get the care you want.
It's not the offerer who goes to prison. It's the nurse who accepts the cash who goes to prison.
Wow. Wow. That would be a
simple
solution.
I don't
know
why I'm laughing. It's really quite sad.
Yeah, it is sad. I mean, so I'm just thinking in my mind about food. So like you said, there are the SNAP program and food support in various ways, people with lower income, but they can decide where to shop. They don't have to only go to Kroger, right?
I mean, that's right. And you never hear of a grocery store saying we're not going to take any more food stamp recipients. So any store you go to, they can go to almost anything in the store that you buy, they can buy. And most important of all, they pay the market price. And the reason that's so important is some MinuteClinics will accept Medicaid patients, but they really are not anxious to. And so in a place like Dallas, I just happened to look the other day to see where they're located. Well, they don't get located in places where Medicaid patients live because they're not anxious to attract those people. But if they could pay market prices, that would totally, we wouldn't have doctor deserts if they could pay market prices.
Yes, right. Like they talk about food deserts, for example, but they're doctor deserts too. So those who are on food support plans, they can choose wherever they want to go. And it doesn't seem to be necessary for the government to take over the supermarket business in order for poorer people to have what they need. Instead, they're provided with supportive vouchers, or you might call it, for food. By the same analogy, I suppose, I'm thinking, like following your line of thought, if they were able to go to the provider of their choice with support, it would have a comparable outcome.
Yeah, now going to the emergency room is lousy for everybody. Dallas, Parkland Hospital is our safety net hospital. The average in and out time is 6 hours. That's what you're looking for.
I've been to them. It's terrible.
And people at the low end of the income scale tend to be hourly workers, so they just lost a day's pay. And a slightly more radical idea is to put money in a health savings account and let these people buy their primary care with those dollars. And then they could have a direct primary care doctor. We used to call them concierge doctors. But they're not all that expensive, like $50 a month for a mother, $10 for a child. You have the doctor's phone number, 24/7 access to that doctor. So at nights and on weekends, you don't have to go to the emergency room. You can check first with your doctor. And that would completely change healthcare for the bottom part of the income ladder in a very, very positive way.
Many of those who advocate government comprehensive control of the healthcare system make the argument on the basis of inequality concerns, that if only the government could control all the aspects of the healthcare system, including insurance, then we wouldn't have such terrible inequality. There'd be so much more equality. Is that accurate, John?
I don't think so. You know, if the British National Health Service, which you mentioned, was started way back after World War II, and the Canadian Medicare system is what they call it, has been around for 20, 25 years. And in those countries, the whole argument was, we want health care to be available to people regardless of their income. And it was supposed to make healthcare access equal for everyone. Well, the British like to study their own institutions. There were two major reports done on how successful they had been on creating equal access to health care. And the bottom line conclusion was that there's just as much inequality today as way back when the system started. So it is not reduced inequality. Inequality persists. And the reason it persists is because you can think of the political system as just a different kind of marketplace. And people who are successful in the private sector market tend to also be successful in a bureaucracy. And so if they have to work with a bureaucracy to get their operation, they figure out how to do that. And people who are less skilled get pushed to the end of the line. Not because anybody's trying to, inequality isn't purposely created in Britain. It is the result of everybody pursuing their own interest in a bureaucratic system.
Right. It's the structure of the incentives, as you keep saying in this great book, Priceless, Curing the Healthcare Crisis, which I encourage our friends to purchase and read and talk about. If we could change the incentives, then the behavior would change and we would not be in this morass.
That's correct.
Speaking of the morass, I've learned a lot by this conversation thus far, John, but I can imagine that some people joining us on this broadcast may be thinking to themselves, well, okay, yeah, this sounds kind of promising. And John Goodman, you know, just like other people, he would like poorer people to have access to healthcare regardless of their income. He just has a better way of doing it. All that's pretty interesting. But really now, John Goodman, is the Obamacare reality presently really so bad? I mean, how bad is it, John? Can you go back to that basic point? How bad is the Obamacare situation now?
Well, if we're talking about the individual market, it's really bad. If you're not getting a subsidy, you take the family of four, average premium, average deductible, add them together, that family has to pay $25,000 before they get any benefit from their plan. And this happens every year. So, and I've already told you, you have narrow networks and you don't have access to the care you may need. So that's very unattractive. And so almost no one is going to buy that insurance without a subsidy. And that's what was happening. The unsubsidized part of that market, which is about 40% of the population, was in a free fall. They weren't buying. And that's why the Democrats in Congress created enhanced subsidies for higher income people. In fact, today you can make almost $600,000 and still get some subsidy from the federal government. Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, you can be rich.
Yeah, this is where you say to save the market, literally to save Obamacare, Democrats in Congress extended subsidies to high-income households. In doing so, they used federal dollars that might otherwise have gone to correct various Obamacare glitches.
That's right. Interesting point. Yes, that's right. The other part of Obamacare that people don't realize is Medicaid expansion. So when Obamacare was sold to the public, everybody thought we're talking about private insurance. That's the way Barack Obama talked about it.
Right.
But today, the percent of the population with private health insurance is just a tiny bit above where it was 10 years ago. So there's been almost no increase in private insurance in this country. And the tiny little bit that we got, we were going to get anyway because we're coming out of recession. We come out of recession, more people get jobs and they get privately insured. So where you keep seeing in the newspaper these numbers on how the number of people insured keeps growing or uninsured keeps falling, what's that all about? It's all about Medicaid. So All the progress of Obamacare in getting people insured has been in Medicaid. And Medicaid is not much more attractive than individual insurance that you buy on your own, because Medicaid isn't accepted by many doctors and many medical centers. It's worse, probably. Yes, yes.
You say at one point, in a very real sense, the ACA was a Medicaid expansion act. And that's because, if I understand you correctly, that the Obamacare incentive structure pushed people ultimately into the arms of Medicaid and out of the regular insurance market. Is that right?
Yeah, it's worse than push. They provided the money for Medicaid expansion, which you get for free, and told people if you don't have income above a certain level, you can't go into the exchanges and buy private insurance. So I think it was 134 4% of poverty. If you were below that, you were not allowed, I think you still are not now, not allowed to buy your own individual insurance and get a subsidy in exchange.
So Obamacare has had the effect of pushing or maybe forcing people into the hands of the government-controlled Medicaid system.
The irony here is that when this was first proposed, everybody thought this was going to be a major change in the healthcare system. It was all going to be based on private insurance and new rules. In fact, all it really was an expansion of Medicaid.
And Medicaid, again, I suppose, is in effect sort of the precursor of what Senator Sanders would like to implement, namely a single-payer government-controlled
system. Oh, he'd probably
like
to have everybody in Medicaid.
Yeah,
I'll tell you one more interesting fact. We're spending $150 billion a year on what's called Obamacare, and that's the subsidies in the exchange plus all the money going to extra money for Medicaid expansion. But over the last decade, there's been no increase in healthcare in the United States. In other words, we're not seeing doctors more often. We don't have more hospital procedures. So we're throwing a lot more money at the system, but doctor visits per capita has actually gone down. So we are not getting more health care, but we're spending more money on health care.
That sounds like a pretty bad deal.
I would think so.
I mean, there's many personal stories, you know, that I hear about the difficulties here. One of my colleagues, I think you know, has a daughter with leukemia, and under the prior system before Obamacare, there was a kind of a market of private insurance that they could have some options in. But over time with Obamacare, the companies pulled out because they couldn't make any money, and they were still free to pull out, and they were left with no insurance options for this child with a quote-unquote pre-existing condition. And supposedly they were going to be better off under Obamacare, but they were far worse off because of what Obamacare did to the private insurance market, if I understand correctly. I hope there aren't thousands of others in that situation, but I fear there may be.
Well, the structure of the system encourages what you just described, because there's a open season when you choose a plan, and then you on the buyer side are locked in for the next 12 months. But over on the seller side, these plans have networks, but they're not locked in. So the individual
right.
you described picked the one cancer center that could treat his daughter, and it was in a network of a plan. So he picks the plan. Now he's locked in for 12 months. And a week or two later, the plan drops the doctor in the clinic. And so now the parents do not have an option for their child. So I don't know how often that's happening, but the structure of the system is set up so that it's always going to be a threat.
Mm-hmm. When I read your book, John, Priceless, Curing the Healthcare Crisis, I actually walk away, I'm shaking my head at the way Obamacare didn't work out as promised, but I also ended up thinking it's kind of hopeful because you actually lay out some things that people across different party lines even could adopt and, you know, appreciate. It's not the end of the world because you actually have laid out a way forward.
Yes, and it's too bad that we don't get more cooperation from the mainstream media. Basically, the only thing you see in the mainstream media about Obamacare is how many additional people have health insurance. They don't write about these high deductibles and these high out-of-pocket risks that people face. I wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal last year, but I'm one of the few. And so most people don't realize, unless they go into the market on their own and start looking at their options, they don't realize what we've really done to the individual market. It used to be insurance was affordable. It was of good quality. If for some reason you were turned down, you could go in a risk pool. That risk pool insurance looks a lot better than Obamacare does today.
When I look at our political leaders talking about these things, I do feel a little perplexed. As we said previously, President Trump apparently doesn't have at the top of his mind what effective changes he did implement when he was in office. And then Vice President Harris, her approach to the subject worries me too, because as in the example of food, apparently she's concerned about increasing food prices. Her proposed solution is to create some kind of a new system that would penalize grocery companies for raising prices when they shouldn't. I guess the same impulse could be behind an approach to healthcare, that if healthcare providers are raising their prices too much, we need to clamp down on them and punish them. That sounds like exactly the wrong solution.
Yes.
When I read about your incentive explanation.
Kamala Harris's view of all this is incredibly naive. And she said, you know, if you get sick, you go to the doctor, you get care. We don't need insurance. Well, if you don't need third-party payer, you know, the hospital does things and the government sends them money. That doesn't sound like very much oversight to me. And
right.
That's really the limit of the thought she seems to have given to any of this.
Well, let's hope that this book makes a splash, John, and that policymakers, both in Congress and in the upcoming administration, whatever it turns out to be, will actually pay attention to some solutions that would lead us forward instead of taking us backward, to coin a political phrase.
Good thought.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, John Goodman, for talking to us about your new book, Priceless: Curing the Healthcare Crisis. I encourage our friends around the country to take a look at this book. You can see it on our website, independent.org, along with a number of important details. You can buy it there. You can buy it on Amazon.com. John, thank you for keeping up the effort to inform the American public that there is a way forward and we don't have to be in this morass of confusion and counterproductive incentives. You're the one who's thought it through from top to bottom.
Thank you, and glad to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Come back again next time, friends, to Independent Conversations. Take care.